starting all the boots. Put them on. We're gonna go get extreme.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Nostool Podcast.
Welcome to the Narstool Podcast. I'm Shannon O'Grady, science nerd and research ranger. We've got JMO here, Jason Morgan, human performance nerd, bike enthusiast, and aspiring ski bum. JMO shared a pretty damn good recipe with me the other day.
Came out pretty good, didn't it?
It did. My garden's going nuts right now. Many eggplants, many tomatoes. I did corn for the first time, ate that. That came out amazing. And I need an eggplant recipe. And since you're the Italian guy,
I'm Italian. I love Italian food. And I follow this dude on Instagram, Chef Maximilian something.
He is straight out of Italy. In Italy.
In Italy. Just super clean, super simple recipes. I love his personality around it all. I sent it over as what? Eggplant?
Yeah.
Chili pepper.
Yep. I switched it up a little bit because my kids were going to eat it. So the chili pepper was a no-go and I had a million tomatoes to use. So I ended up using those instead. But yeah, the surprising ingredient to me was mint.
That caught me off guard too.
Yeah. It was good though.
But it was nice. It was kind of bright and refreshing and it kind of bounced off the pecorino a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Did you use pecorino?
I did use pecorino. And then you added... Always got to have the protein, pan-seared protein. I did not have that. So
I'm that guy.
I went fishwife canned smoked salmon.
I like that. Yeah. No, I'm the asshole who can't just eat a vegetarian meal. I know
protein is not exclusively omnivorous. There are vegetarian sources of protein.
The problem is that I'm hungry in 20 minutes and the amount of volume I need to consume of plant-based proteins is absurd. So you can make fun of me, but it was delicious. I added pan-seared wild-caught salmon. Yeah, I don't know. It's a hurdle of mine I need to get through.
No, I think that's a good thing. I'm just poking fun.
I have to add animal protein to all my meals. Yeah, I don't know. It's probably in my head more than anything.
Maybe. Our guests today could probably let you know whether
we could work through this with some of our two guests today. This week, we've got Dana Belinsky, Director of Performance Nutrition at University of Colorado Boulder, and Dr. Karen Van Bock, Sport and Exercise Medicine Physician. Dana, Dr. Van Bock, welcome to the Narstool.
Hi, thank you for having us.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to have you guys on. I would say like we now have four nerds at the table, which is amazing. And I'm really excited about a lot of what we're going to talk about today because both of you have done a lot of research in relative energy deficiency in sport, which I think is such an important topic. I think it would be a good place to kind of define what relative energy deficiency in sport is and maybe connect it to what many of us used to call the female athlete triad. One of you want to jump in and give us a general definition?
Yeah, I can get us started. So basically, relative energy deficiency in sport, which we call REDS for short, is a situation where someone isn't getting enough caloric fuel, so just not getting enough calories in their diet to compensate for what they're doing in physical activity, and then also keep up with the energy that their body needs to just pump your heart and move around your house during the day. And when that happens, depending on how bad that nutritional deficit is, you can have issues with a whole range of your body systems. So the things we think about that are most obvious are, for women, their reproductive cycle will be interrupted, so they may stop getting their period. And then it can also affect your bone health. And so because we see this a lot in distance runners, it often comes with us seeing difficulties with stress fractures. So the female athlete triad, which was originally identified and described kind of in the 90s, was the set of those three things. So a nutritional deficiency, trouble with bone health, and trouble with a woman's reproductive cycle or a female's reproductive cycle. And what we've realized over the years is there's actually a larger set of issues that can come when someone is kind of undernourished like this chronically. And so there was a group of smart people who suggested that we expand the definition and call this REDS, just to acknowledge that there's more going on than just those three systems, and also acknowledge that negative things can happen in males as well as females. So, I think that's the short story.
Yeah, that's a great definition. I love that you touched on both kind of the multifaceted, symptomology associated with REDS, and then also the fact that it's not female specific, that males can also be impacted. And Dana, a lot of your research focuses on males and relative or in REDS. I'll just shorten it for the remainder of the podcast. Can you talk to us a little bit about your research and what motivated you to get into this research topic?
Yeah. So most recently, we started doing some research around dietary restriction. So outside of an eating disorder, we still see people who choose to restrict certain foods or food groups. And this can be because of a medical diagnosis, you know, an individual who may have celiac disease or a food allergy, they 100% should restrict that food. But also being in Boulder, we see a lot of other dietary restrictions. So, and that can come with different fads that we see coming up on the internet, or different influencers too. So we were investigating how does that impact bone health. We're both a little bit of a bone health nerds. And so that was our most recent research that we've started pursuing, and just trying to understand how can that impact an individual right now as an athlete, but also long-term as well, because we do know that bone health is not just something that happens right away, but it can have long-term lifetime impacts as well.
Yeah, I love that you brought up the specificity of like a non-eating disorder dietary restriction. It also made me think, because I think often when people hear REDS, they think that the energy restriction piece is purposeful. But it could be because of an energy restriction. It could also just be because an individual doesn't realize that there's a mismatch between energy intake and energy expenditure. Can you guys talk a little bit about that? Maybe Dana start, and Karen also, I'd love to hear from you.
Yeah, so that was one of the cool things when they switched from calling it the female athlete triad to REDS, was acknowledging that it could be both intentional underfueling or unintentional underfueling as well. And I think there's still a lot of stigma out there that REDS is purposeful. But more and more in our practice, we see a lot of unintentional underfueling, just because athletes may not understand quite how much they need for the work that they're doing. Especially with endurance athletes, if you see an athlete training really hard, running crazy mileage per week, to be able to understand what that actually looks like on their plate, can be really challenging too. And we can only take in so much food at one time. So it can be a tricky balance between how do I eat enough to make sure that I'm fueling for my sport and the training that I'm doing, but also how can I make sure that I'm not feeling overly full or overly stuffed from any of these meals that I'm having. So that's where, you know, working with a dietitian or specifically a sports dietitian can be really helpful. So that way you can understand how much do I actually need? When should I be putting that in? What should my plate look like? So that way I can support the training that I'm doing.
I'm curious, within those athletes, are you kind of isolating endurance-based sports versus like weight class-based sports? So, you know, first thing that comes to mind would be like wrestling or boxing, who these people have to hit a certain weight class, so there is purposeful caloric restriction going on. How do you control for that within your work?
Yeah, we don't have any weight class sports at CU, but I do have a lot of friends who do work with weight class sports, and just hearing about how specific you need to be for that is really fascinating too, because there's a way that you can cut for weight class sports that is healthy and going to be the best for the athlete. And then there's other ways that may not necessarily be supportive for them long term. And so it's a really fine balance with those types of sports to make sure that an individual is still getting what they need to be able to compete in their sport and compete in whatever matches they have coming up, but still being able to compete at a high level where they're properly fueled for that type of event.
It's a really great question because we know that, right? Like there's an element to performance. You know, you think about cyclists, like distance cyclists, right? It's the Tour de France time. There's an element to which a lighter bike human system takes less energy to move forward. And so we can't ignore that. But I think it just, we find that the messaging gets confused a lot between how do you talk to an endurance athlete or a weight class athlete about properly getting their body to the right body composition at the right time in their season to perform at their highest, but doing it in a healthy way. And just because there's so much stigma around this, I think it can be really delicate kind of getting people into that working relationship. And like Dana said, as a physician, my most important relationship there is getting someone in with a good sports dietitian that they can trust and that they can really build that relationship with, where they're going to be open and honest and have a dietitian who's going to be open and honest and everyone respects each other's goals, because it can be a really tough problem.
Yeah, Dr. Van Buck, that was one of the things I was going to ask you next, actually, is I'm curious about your interaction with somebody that's coming in to see you. What are some maybe... I hesitate to use the word warning signs, but things you're looking for that might be an indication that red S could be something that you're concerned about, and that maybe connecting this individual with a dietitian would be a good next step.
Yeah. The most obvious things, and this is something that's still not, you'd be surprised, I think, that this is something that's still not understood by a lot of, especially high school level coaches, or a lot of primary care physicians, is that a 16-year-old who's not getting her period, that's bad. Like, that's a red flag. We need to figure out what's going on. And if that person is an athlete or just doing a lot of physical activity, a dietary assessment should be a part of that workup. Stress fractures. I think there's also a misconception in endurance sports that getting 3 tibia stress fractures during high school is normal. We think that that's something that really needs to be looked into, partly because when we're talking about bone growth, we really want to fix that at a young age, because adolescence is a super, super important time for people to be building their bones. The other thing, though, that I would say, just coming from both a university practice at CU and then a community practice in Boulder, seeing a lot of endurance athletes, but runners, cyclists, Nordic skiers, is oftentimes I'll have people come in who are just tired and not recovering the way that they expect to, or their resting heart rate isn't what they expect it to be, or their performance is suffering. And that's not always REDS, but a lot of the time REDS is a component. So that's a big message that I like to send people, is anything that's wrong with your performance, even if it's little things, you're not sleeping as well as you normally would be, your mood has changed, any of that could be a sign of REDS. And it's low effort. Well, I guess people have to get in with a good dietitian, but aside from that, you know, it's not drawing blood. All we really need is to get someone in to get a really thorough dietary assessment with someone who's skilled at that, just to see if that's what's going on.
Within that dietary assessment, Dana, I think this is probably more of a question for you. Do you get with some of the coaches or the strength and conditioning coaches to look at their training block and to make sure there is adequate rest? I come from the strength and conditioning world, and overtraining is such a big thing, especially with endurance athletes, where it's, you have to program rest times. So do you work closely with those coaches to make sure all of that's lined up?
Yeah, we work really closely with our sport coaches as well as strength and conditioning coaches as well. My office is right outside the weight room at CU, so we're always seeing our athletes as they go in and when they come out. I get to see our strength coaches every single day, and there's always that open line of communication too. And so, you know, I work very closely with our physicians. So when we're talking about providing the best care for an athlete when it comes to REDS, it's having that interdisciplinary approach, because I can be working with the athlete on increasing their fueling, but if our sport coaches aren't on board, our strength coaches aren't on board, if the athlete's not on board too, then we're not going to have as much success in promoting that recovery that we would if everyone was working together. And when we talked about REDS, you know, there's so many different factors that go into it. So when you're taking an approach to treat it, there should be many factors going in as well. And that's from the medical side, our physicians, athletic trainers, physios, to strength coaches and coaches as well, to really make it that collaborative approach to get out of that hole and promote that recovery as well.
I'm curious, you know, we talked about intentional versus unintentional REDS, or I guess eating behaviors that lead to REDS. And you mentioned earlier kind of maybe internet driven restrictions in the diet by fads and things of that nature. And I think orthorexia, or like this fascination or overemphasis on clean eating, seems like it is something that I see building, especially in today's day and age. How much of the individuals that you've come into, individuals that you've come to relate to via either coming into your practice, Dr. Van Bock, or that you've seen as an athlete, Dana, fall into that category where it might not be restriction due to an health issue like celiacs. It might not be restriction due to an eating disorder where caloric restriction is the goal, but it might be more of this, you know, fascination with eliminating food groups or eliminating specific foods that really ends up being the problem.
I think I always see a huge uptick after some Netflix documentary comes out.
Yeah.
And I think it's important to really focus on that relationship. You know, being a dietitian, I get to spend a lot of time with the athletes. And so having that foundation is really key. So that way you can sit down and talk to them and say, okay, well, what was the claim they made? And let's talk through what the actual science is. And I find that approaching it from that science-based background and providing them the evidence can really help them understand, you know, do I need to go vegan, or can I still fuel and maybe make a few different food choices to help support me, but still incorporating maybe some meat to help promote my recovery and protein intake, just for example. But I think constantly bringing it back to the science and showing them the evidence versus showing them big claims is really key.
Yeah, that's great to hear, because I feel like coming out of a period where carbs were, you know, the bad guy for such a long time, and especially given, I mean, REDS doesn't seem like it's exclusive to endurance athletes, but it mm-hmm. does feel like there's a correlation between those types of sports and caloric restriction, and especially in a sport like an endurance sport where carbs are really key to performance and to recovery, those two things seem like they could cause a major problem. So I have loved seeing the emphasis on the importance of carbs and fueling that I feel like has started as of late.
Yeah, I love the high carb fueling movement that we're in right now. It's really exciting too. And when we're also talking about the team sport athletes, we do see REDS in those athletes as well. I think there's a lot of emphasis on the endurance athletes just due to the history of the sports. But we also need to focus on those team sport athletes too, because we'll have teams doing two-a-days. They're running up and down the field. It's hot out. They might be feeling a little under the weather after practice where they can't fully ingest a meal. So really making sure that, you know, any athlete, any human who's active, to be honest, can potentially experience REDS. And so it's important to remove that stigma that, oh, it just happens to endurance athletes, or it just happens to female athletes, and that really any athlete can experience it.
Dana, I'm curious from like a real life use case with some of your college athletes. I was a college athlete and juggling practice, class, tutoring, all the things, like enough time to eat. So how, like, you work with the basketball team, I believe. How do you advise your players, like, add this, do that? How can you help them consume enough calories? I mean, if you're 19 years old and you're playing basketball at the D1 level, you're expending a shit ton of calories, and then you have to immediately run a class, then you immediately have to get to the gym, then you immediately have to go to the athletic training. Like, How do they have enough time and how do you help them through that?
Yeah, it's a lot. I think it's meeting them where they're at, both figuratively and literally. So understanding what time practice ends and saying, okay, I know you're not going to sit down for a full meal, shower, go to the training room and get to class in 30 minutes. That's just not happening. So how can I meet you there? And sometimes it's meeting them there with a burrito in hand, handing it to them as they're walking out and making sure that they're getting something on their way to class too. So nutrition advice without an intervention doesn't really do any good. So trying to figure out how can we actually make this practical? Because I can say, here's the most beautiful meal that you can have after a training session. But if we don't have a made-to-order omelet station ready and available after basketball practice in the locker room, what good is it to do to say, make sure you get an omelet after practice? So we always have to think of that practical aspect and understanding, okay, can we throw something in your bag? Is this where we're going to rely on more of the sports nutrition products? So that way they can have that snack in their bag versus having a fresh, made from scratch meal too. So it's a lot of understanding what it is that these athletes need. And we're very fortunate at CU to have a very robust food service program. So we're able to serve our athletes three meals a day, Monday through Friday. And it's really convenient within our athletic facilities. So our athletes can run upstairs, grab some food. We have to-go boxes. We place late box orders too if they get there after the meals close, to really just make it accessible to them. And I think when we're talking about, you know, the general population, so outside of college athletics, because some of us have aged out of that program, we want to make sure that we're thinking of it in the same way when we're talking about going to work. What snacks do I have with me at work? So that way when I leave and I go on my training ride, go on my hike after work, I'm going to go into that well-fueled too. So it's understanding not only the science of what your body needs, but that practical aspect and what that's going to look like for you. And also, is it something that you actually like? Because that's another big hurdle too. If you don't like it, you're not going to eat it. So how can we slowly nudge people in the direction we want, but also make it taste good, make it fun, and make it something that they'll enjoy eating and fueling with?
Yeah, I love that, Dana, because I do feel like behavior is such a big part of nutrition. And so addressing it from that aspect seems critical. I'm curious, like, also, I feel like we're in this day and age where kids start training hard so young, whether they just get serious early or parents put them in programs that, you know, have multiple practices a week, let alone a day. And nutrition, a lot of nutrition habits can be formed at a young age. Do you have any advice for parents or even coaches that might be listening about how to make sure your kid's getting enough food or how to maybe address nutrition at a young age when kids might not be that interested in listening?
Yeah, I think it starts with the adults. We can talk to the kids, but the ones who are going to the grocery store are the coaches, the parents, and trying to have that food accessible for them and teach those fueling habits and promoting a healthy language around fueling for not only your athlete, but the team. So we're going to have a pre-workout fuel and maybe it's, you know, some carbohydrate rich snacks, whether it's graham crackers or oranges or something along those lines to make it easy for the parents too, because I get that running around a lot, it's hard. And then taking those water breaks and using that supportive language around fueling during those water breaks with the Gatorade, a sports drink to help provide those carbohydrates as well. And using that language and building it into the practices in the training session or in your car rides to and from your practices as well. But Karen has done some research on early sports specialization too. She might have some additional insight there.
Yeah, everything you said, Dana, I think for me, when I talk to younger patients and their parents, the two keys are having a positive relationship with food, fostering a positive relationship with food. And this is me kind of putting my eating disorder physician hat on, saying food is not good or bad. Food is food. And what you need is enough food. You need food that works for your body. You need food that works for your lifestyle. But food in and of itself is not inherently good or bad. So really, like Dana said, fostering that positive relationship with food and positive talk around food early, which is hard as parents. And I think I have a four-year-old. It's hard as a mom who grew up in the Kate Moss era in the 90s, right? I did not grow up with a positive relationship with food. So I'm having to relearn a lot of that in the way that I talk to my daughter. The other thing, though, is I think we also have this idea in youth sports that we have to match the nutrition to whatever's happening in the kids' training world, whereas sometimes the right thing to do is actually to adjust their training load. I think in the United States in particular, kids are just really overcommitted and they're really overtrained. And like we were talking about earlier, not all fatigue with training is REDS. Sometimes it's overtraining. Sometimes it's not getting enough rest. So we also have to recognize that for a lot of kids, if they're having difficulty, it may be that they aren't getting enough rest. And there's a really good set of guidelines from the American Academy of Pediatrics on how to periodize, what we call periodize sports for kids. So making sure kids get a full kind of a long break from organized sports, usually over the summer, making sure they're playing more than one sport, and making sure they're getting good rest in between that, making sure they're sleeping at night, all of these things. So I think it's kind of attacking it from both sides.
I would love to kind of go down that tangent of early specialization and talk about some of your research. I used to do some work up here in Utah with the youth athletic development model. So early specialization, I think, is a horrible thing for kids, and diversifying the stress on their bodies is a good thing. And then also just letting them be kids. Can you talk a little bit, Karen, about some of the research you've done and the benefits of delaying specialization? And in your mind, what is an appropriate age to specialize?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And it's interesting that we're getting to the point in this area of research that the answer is probably different for different sports. If we think about bone health in particular, which is the lens that Dana and I often look through from a research standpoint, we have pretty good evidence that kids who grow up doing what we call multi-directional loading sports build bone better than kids who grew up doing either unweighted sports or what we call unidirectional loading sports. So if you take a cross-section of kids coming in from multiple sports to college, you'll see that the kids who grew up playing basketball, soccer, who were jumping and running and cutting, their bone density is higher than kids who grew up distance running, where they're doing impact activity, but it's the same direction all the time, right? They're just running in a straight line. And those kids have higher bone density than kids who grow up riding bikes or swimming. So just the sport that someone is doing is important for their bone health in particular. And one question we really have, but this needs to be studied as an intervention, is whether putting kids who look like they're promising distance runners, putting them into other sports or building them in plyometric programs or building them in strength training programs when they're young will help develop their bone density better than just having them do distance running. So that's a really exciting area of research. We started to look in our cohort at the University of Colorado, where we're doing this bone density study, at our athletes who specialized in their sport earlier. And we actually didn't find that for our distance runners, we didn't find that those who specialized earlier had better bone density. Now, there's a lot of, that's very kind of preliminary data, just based on the type of study that we had. And we'll get more as we go through time with this study. But I think it really points out that the question is really complicated, and there's going to be more than just one answer to why an 18-year-old distance runner comes into college with poor bone density, and it's probably their nutrition. It's probably the type of sports they did. It's probably their muscle mass. It's probably any other medical conditions they had. It's what their diet looked like in high school, and it's probably the sports that they did. So it's probably going to be a whole bunch of things going on. But what I realized in the end is doing this idealized thing that, like, you know, we hopefully did in the 90s, where you just like run around in the street and play all sports and like shoot baskets, even though you're not very good at it, and don't join a team and tell you're older and play three sports in high school, even if you're not that good. That's probably the best way to develop athletes.
Yeah, I love that. That's great advice. And I feel like the push to get kids serious in one particular sport is starting earlier and earlier. Yeah, I think that advice lands super well, along with the positive association between food and your body and fueling, also an important one. I think as a parent also that grew up in that age, and even before that, when we were in the snack well, fat shaming, you know, period. Yeah, I've had to lose a lot of what was embedded in me as a child when I try to turn around. And I often catch myself turn around and talk to my daughter and my son about nutrition and try to promote more of balance. Like, yeah, there's not good foods or bad foods, but we need to balance the types of foods that we're including in our diet. Get some fruits and veggies in, and, you know, have nerds occasionally when you want them.
Yeah.
So I appreciate that you guys touched on both of those things. I'm curious, the bone density, obviously, I'm assuming you guys use a DEXA scan as primary measure of that. Is that the only, like, that takes some time, obviously, to both have an athlete come in and take that measurement and also to analyze it. Are there any faster measurements that you guys use almost as a proxy to know whether or not a DEXA is necessary?
I would say the main thing is looking at all the facets of reds and seeing if someone has red flags. So there's a couple of risk scoring tools that we use. One that's specific is for female athletes in the female athlete triad, looking at those three domains, and then one that's a little bit more comprehensive with reds. And right now, what we're supposed to be doing as sports medicine physicians is saying, you know, if I have someone who comes in with the things we talked about earlier, multiple stress fractures, missing their period, also losing weight, trouble with performance, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. These things that make us think they might have reds, then we should think about doing a bone density scan. And it's interesting. You know, I think the clinical practice is really different depending on who you see, whether you see a physician first or a dietitian or a physical therapist first, what type of physician you see. So my advice when I talk to just other parents outside of my medical practice hat is to educate themselves about what this condition is, educate themselves about how important it is to build bone density when kids are young, and advocate for that. You know, a DEXA actually doesn't take very long to do. It's a lower dose of radiation than just a chest x-ray, and it does not cost very much. And for the right reason, it's almost always covered by insurance. So it's actually a pretty easy test to run. And it's an easy thing, I think, for parents to, well, easy. You would hope that it's an easy thing for parents or for patients themselves to advocate for with their physician. And often it just takes a question of, hey, you know, I've missed my period for 6 months now, and I had a couple of stress fractures when I was growing up. Do you think I should get a bone density scan? And usually that's something that's pretty easy to do.
Great advice. I've talked to a few of our athletes that have been diagnosed with REDS and had bone density scans that indicate that they may be kind of walking down that path towards osteoporosis later in life. Can you talk a little bit about once an individual realizes that they have been in an energy deficit and that they do potentially have an impact in terms of their bone growth, what it looks like to come back from that? Like, can dietary interventions and fueling correctly help, you know, in the future with whether or not you're going to have symptoms of osteoporosis?
Yes. Yes. Yes.
Good. And that's great news. Why. Yeah.
Well, I can start. You can jump in. I kind of think of it like a, you know, you dig yourself into a hole. So it depends on how big that hole is in order for you to get yourself out and what that training looks like while you're digging yourself out of that hole too. If we see an athlete digging themselves into a hole, having a stress fracture, that training might actually be lower to allow themselves to climb out a little bit faster. And this kind of goes back to what we were talking about earlier of working with the coaches, working with strength coaches, and whatever the athlete's training plan is to make sure that we're allowing them that time to recover and to get out of that hole too. So when we're talking about bone health too, and I can talk from the nutrition side and Karen, you can pick up from there. But then when we're talking about, okay, let's increase those calories to get ourselves out of that hole, let's also take a look at the micronutrients that we're putting into your body on top of the timing and overall intake that an individual is doing. So the big ones when we're talking about bone health are vitamin D, which can be looked at through blood work and easily supplemented as well, and then calcium intake. So taking a dietary recall, assessing how frequently are we consuming calcium, is that going to be close to what your needs are, or should we supplement? And I think finding that balance, and again, approaching it from multiple angles can help over time. And also understanding that, you know, I think nutrition sometimes tries to be overly sexy, and, you know, it's doing the same thing consistently. It's consistently fueling for your training, consistently fueling for recovery, consistently fueling throughout the day, consistently taking your vitamin D, consistently getting in calcium. That's going to be what makes an individual successful and healthy over the long term. And so remembering that it doesn't just stop once you run out of your vitamin D supplement. No, we should continue to take that if your blood work indicates that, or we should continue to fuel when you get back to training. And that consistency over the long term can be really beneficial, especially when we're talking about digging yourself out of that red hole and promoting overall bone health as well.
Quick question. I think we skipped over it a little bit. What is the cutoff for reds defined as percentage of caloric deficit? Like, is there a range where, you know, are you under 10%, less than you need, 20%? How are you defining the actual deficit?
Yeah, there is a definition, and it's measured in calories per kilogram of fat-free mass. So it's measured in what you take in, basically adjusted for an individual's body composition, like body size and composition, and then how does it relate to their daily energy expenditure in terms of exercise, and then just what you expect. There are formulas for what to expect for, you know, a 35-year-old woman in their daily life, right? There is, Dana can maybe talk about this a little bit more than I can, but there's some recent thought in the literature that there may be a little bit more nuance and the numbers might be a little bit different for men than women, for males than females, and the numbers might be a little bit different depending how long you're in certain calorie deficit. But yeah, that's kind of how it's measured.
Got it.
Yeah. So measuring energy availability is really hard. The general cutoff is less than 30 calories per kilogram of fat-free mass. So again, that involves additional testing to be able to understand what that individual's fat-free mass is. But I think we know a lot from the research that reporting on your dietary intake isn't always accurate. So it does involve a bit of detective work when you're working with an athlete to say, okay, what did you have for breakfast? How much protein did you have? Okay, what is 50 grams of protein at breakfast actually look like for you? And being able to understand what was the food that athlete took in and actually consumed too. I just lost my train of thought.
Was it around this idea of like whether or not there's like when somebody comes into you, if you're diagnosing them via their symptoms or if you're diagnosing them via a nutrition survey relative to energy spent exercising or time spent exercising?
Yeah. So it's kind of doing a lot of that detective work to kind of piece it all together, because it can also be a diagnosis of exclusion too. And so understanding, okay, is there anything else medically going on that we're seeing from our sports medicine staff? And then diving in deeper just to make sure we're ruling everything out before being able to assign that REDS diagnosis.
And Karen mentioned time, which was something that I was thinking of both when Jason was asking about weight class athletes, you know, like or strength athletes like that might cut weight for a particular competition. So it might be a short-lived caloric restriction, but then also people that might be trying to better their body composition, even in a healthy way where you do see some caloric restriction until they get to that weight and may work to more of a maintenance level of calories. So can you speak a little bit to that time piece, which I think also touches on Jason's point with the degree of caloric restriction? Like, when do we get into the danger zone?
I think, you know, it depends on the individual and also the training that we're doing. There is some research that suggests even within 2 weeks of that clinical 30 calories per kilogram of fat-free mass is enough to start to see disruption. And that was measured in a lab. So some individuals might begin to experience that after 2 weeks, where it might take a couple more weeks or months to manifest in a symptom that an athlete is naturally going to recognize. I think athletes are also tough, right? We say push through. That's part of training too. So it's hard to recognize that fatigue and understand where that tipping point is for athletes too. There's also research on even what they call intraday energy, relative energy deficiency. Sorry, none of these words just like roll right off the tongue.
No, you're so right.
I'm within like, next day, time you do research, I'm going to pick an easier topic with easier abbreviations, because sometimes my brain just really has to think. But within day energy deficiency, so that looks at across the period of the day, you might be getting in enough calories. But around that training time, if you're going in under fueled, you might start to experience some symptoms of relative energy deficiency, because you're going to be under fueled and unable to recover. And your body is going to mobilize more of its stores and start to break things down in order to fuel that training. There's also interesting research coming out on overall carbohydrate intake too. So I'm really excited to see, we haven't gotten to a number yet to understand carbohydrate availability and how that can influence specifically bone health. But I'm really excited to see the research that's continuing to develop to understand where exactly is that range going to be for athletes too. And, you know, these are all really great ideas. And I think it just kind of highlights that there's more research that needs to be done. And this needs to be talked about more with athletes, physicians, parents, everyone to really start approaching this from all different angles and see what the nuances are within it.
We've talked a little bit about, you know, back in the day when fat was bad and, you know, we're kind of hopefully recovering from a carbohydrate shaming period. We're obviously in a high protein all the time period, but I also feel like something I hear so many people talk about is hormone levels. Like, everybody wants to know what their hormone levels are. And in some cases, I think it's extremely important. As a woman that's in perimenopause, like, I'm paying attention to that. In other cases, I'm like, 30-year-old male, your testosterone levels are probably fine. Chill out. But I know that REDS is something that can obviously in females, since it can impact menstruation, obviously there's an impact on hormones. Karen, can you talk a little bit about what the hormonal impact of energy deficits could possibly be in both males and females?
Great question. So the way that REDS affects the hormonal system is through something that we call a functional suppression of the hypothalamic pituitary axis, which means that the body isn't physically injured, like there hasn't been a brain injury or a poison, but because the body senses something isn't going right, it starts to kind of shut down non-essential functions. And so it does that by suppressing part of your hormonal system. And it does that, the way the body's hormones work is in all these chains. This gland produces these hormones that tell this gland what to do, on and on and on and on. So the body tells the master gland, hey, we need to stop this person's ability to reproduce. And so it starts to shut all these things down. Unfortunately, for females, the end hormonal result of one of those chains is estrogen. And for males, the end hormonal result of that same chain is testosterone. And both testosterone and estrogen are really, really important for stimulating the body's bone building system. So the bone issue with Reds is that not only it is not getting enough calories directly affect the body's ability to build bone because it needs to take calcium from somewhere. But also shutting down that hormonal system is also bad for bone building. Now, shutting down that hormonal system is also bad for other things. Mood, right? We know this from, we have the best case study in what happens when you shut down a female's hormonal reproductive axis. It's called menopause, right? And so women are tired and they're have difficulty with their mood and they have difficulty recovering and they may have changes to their skin and their health might suffer, you know, their physical health, they might get sick more often. So those things, the same type of things that women experience in an extreme way during menopause are the symptoms that women can have when shutting down their reproductive axis at a young age. And I think it's been really interesting. This is something that you don't read about, but something that I started to notice in my practice is young women having their hormonal axis turned on normally for the first time in their life would feel better in ways that they didn't even realize they were feeling so terrible. So that's kind of how Reds affects the reproductive hormonal system. There's lots of other things to say about lots of other hormonal systems in Reds. The one thing I will say, though, that isn't quite as easy as we always want it to be is there's not just a quick lab test that I can run to check your hormones, quote unquote, and will tell you if you have Reds or not. So there are things as a sports medicine physician that I need to do if I suspect someone has Reds, but still to really make that diagnosis, especially when it's pretty subtle and early, that's really something I need a good dietitian to help me with. So it's important. The hormonal system is important, but it's not something that's just easy to, you know, hop over to LabCorp yourself, get a hormonal panel, and you'll know if you have Reds. It's not that simple.
So for women, we talked about how Reds shows up as loss of menstruation in men. What are some of the signs and symptoms that men should be looking out for?
Yeah, great question. This has not been studied as much, so a little bit of this is inference. Just based on what we know happens to men who have low testosterone levels, but basically Reds can eventually cause a low testosterone level. And because men don't menstruate, there's not as clear of a symptom that shows up immediately. But what we think about are the same kind of symptoms we think about as men get older and have a natural decline in their testosterone. So you might see change in sexual function, change in libido, erectile dysfunction, change in morning erection frequency. You might maybe see changes in body hair. That's us kind of guessing. Like I said, this hasn't been studied particularly well. And then the other thing you'll see is just change in energy levels, fatigue, low testosterone can cause a lot of difficulties. I will say this is also something that's really not widely known amongst the community of physicians who take care of young men's health. So I have had young adult male patients who were diagnosed with low testosterone and just put on testosterone replacement in kind of a men's health clinic in a way that might have been appropriate if they were 70 and having an age-related decline in testosterone. But in someone with REDS, that doesn't fix the issue. And it messes up our blood work ability to monitor their REDS with their testosterone level. So that's another thing that it's just really important for athletes to be aware of, for male athletes to be aware of and be able to advocate for themselves, is that a 21-year-old ultramarathoner with low testosterone is different than a 75-year-old with low testosterone.
Yeah, I think that's a great point to bring up, because it seems like in that case, someone that might be less familiar with REDS or less familiar with sport in general and the implications that underfueling can have may be treating that symptom and not thinking necessarily about the reason for it. So thanks for making that distinction, Karen. Super, super useful. I'm curious, we talked a little bit about osteoporosis, obviously, in the female context, and there's a direct connection there with estrogen. Do you also see bone health issues in males?
Yeah, has not been studied particularly well in young men, but anecdotally, I will tell you, amongst kind of sport endocrine people and sports medicine physicians and dietitians in our world who live in kind of the Mountain West and the West, who see especially a lot of cyclists, that can be, those like cycling related fractures in young people can be a real red flag for bone health issues. And that's known to be, that's for a long time has been known to be an issue in high level male cyclists, both because they don't do a weight bearing sport and because of the leanness issue in that sport, there can be a high incidence of REDS. So yeah, we definitely can see bone health issues in males. We see a lot of stress fractures in male distance runners, just like we do in female distance runners. And I think it's really easy. I think it's really easy to overlook it, because osteoporosis is a problem that's more prevalent in women, and because women with osteoporosis get more fractures and have more downstream effects from their fractures with osteoporosis. It is really, really important, and we need more research into osteoporosis in women. And we can't forget that it happens in men also.
Karen, this, I'm going to start this question with you, and then I kind of want to roll it up into Dana. Like, the role of pharmacological like side effects and people's desire to eat, whether it's intentional or unintentional. So ADD medication is known to just destroy appetite. Pop culture now, GLP-1s, people are using these. I know it's going to sprinkle in athletics at some point. So the unintended consequences of putting people in a caloric deficit with ADD medication, and then, you know, how do you unravel some of that with your patients and consider some of those things?
Just easy questions for us today.
I mean, it's self-serving.
Jason.
Yeah, like my daughter has ADHD and we medicate her for it. And one of our uphill battles every single day is just helping her eat. She's like, dude, I'm just not hungry.
I know.
And it's, she's nine. No, she's 10. She needs to eat, and she's, you know, so I'm just curious, like the unintended consequences of this, and how do you help people work through it?
Yeah. It's a super good question. I joke because it's genuinely just a really tricky problem. And I think you're asking, it's interesting there. I think I have something to say differently about those two situations. Things like the GLP-1, I don't really know what to say so much about that, other than the fact that it worries me. And it worries me for the same reason that we got into this low carb craze and we got into this low fat craze, is that American diet culture or Western diet culture often trickles down into regular people who don't need to lose weight, thinking that that's actually just a healthy way to eat. But it's not. It was just developed as an effective way to lose weight. And we do have an obesity problem, but is a medication that just gets you to lose weight really quickly the right answer, when it also is a medication that's now showing to be associated with a lot of skeletal muscle loss? Like, that really concerns me for someone's bone health. So that's a really tricky issue that, I don't know, you guys should have three different episodes about that. And I'm not the right one to talk about all of it. The ADD medication. Oh, yeah. Go ahead, Dana.
On the GLP-1, I think what you know, concerns me the most is also that skeletal muscle loss. And we see that across people using that. And again, I'm not an expert in GLP-1s, but when we think about osteoporosis in the older population, one of the concerns is the elderly population losing muscle tissue. So if we're seeing that with GLP-1s, what does that mean 20, 30 years down the line as well? Yeah. And so I think, you know, I, again, not an expert in it, but from what I've learned and listened to on it is really making sure that protein content is up and also doing some type of strength exercise to help promote muscle tissue maintenance or even gain throughout the use of a GLP-1.
And I think just being cautious, right? You know, I tend to not personally be an early adopter of things like that. And I know that drugs go through a really rigorous approval process, but you cannot study a drug for 20 years and still get it onto the market in a time effective way. So to some extent, there's always going to be information that comes out later after a drug has been developed. Your question about stimulants is really good. And I honestly don't have a straightforward answer other than to throw it back to Dana and to echo what she was talking about in terms of working with our college athletes in terms of the constraints around their daily fueling. And in that situation, I think that my most powerful tool as a physician is just to validate you as a parent when you're saying, this is a really hard problem. And for me to say, yes, it is a really hard problem. We can find you a team. We can work on fixing it, but it's not hard because you've done anything wrong. It's not hard because your kid has done anything wrong. It just is hard. It's just difficult. And it's going to take time and it's going to take creativity to figure out what works right for your family. But none of that means that anyone's doing anything wrong. And it doesn't mean your kid shouldn't be on a stimulant for their quality of life. It just is going to take kind of work and creativity. And so for me, the most important thing is just validating people in that.
Yeah. And then getting to the practical side of that too, is understanding how each individual responds to the medication. Is it the appetite declines right away? Is it over the course of the day? And then trying to understand, you know, when are they taking the medication and how can I build some meals around that to help those individuals eat when they're feeling hungry, and then understanding, okay, is there a certain point within the middle of the day where we need to set a timer on the phone that says, okay, it's lunchtime, or it's time for my morning snack or my afternoon snack before I go to soccer practice, to try and help establish a routine and create habits that'll support them in whatever your family needs to. But yeah, it's not a one size, you know, fits all approach. And it does take a little bit of troubleshooting there.
Yeah, it's definitely an uphill battle in our house. And I'm just, you feel for her, you know, she obviously needs the medication to get through her day at school and all the things, but also like, kiddo, you need some food. Mm-hmm. You get a little hangry.
I think a lot of it is awareness, right? So you're doing the right thing by being aware. The other thing that's both challenging and a blessing, I think, with kids is your daughter at 10 is totally different than who your daughter is at 9, right? So like, things also change fast. At least I just keep telling myself that, my cranky toddler.
Different challenges at different ages, for sure. I'm curious. I love that energy deficiency, energy availability. Those are terms we hear more and more often. And we did talk about how getting parents and coaches on board early and making sure that young athletes are getting the nutrition and overall energy in that they need to not just fuel their sport, but also to grow is critical. What do you, are you guys aware of any educational programs within a sport or within maybe a organization that's trying to get parents and coaches information so that they can make sure they're starting to have these conversations about proper fueling early?
I'm not aware of any programs, but that's a great idea. And I think there's some really good resources, websites or communities that are can be helpful. There is the Project REDS They have an Instagram page as well as a website and community. There's also the Female Athlete Health Clinic at Boston Children's Hospital through the WSI Alliance. They also have a partnership at Stanford, and their program's called FASTER. I don't remember what every abbreviation stands for there, but it's, again, focused mainly on female athletes, but the concept of RED's there too. There's also an organization called Voice in Sports that is geared for young female athletes and promoting healthy participation in sports as well. And I think, you know, we did talk about how the internet and social media can influence things, but you can always flood your Instagram with positive influences as well. And so I think following those channels, seeing that reminder when you're scrolling and seeing, hey, did you know carbohydrates help fuel your run? Can be really exciting and a way to approach this younger population as well.
Yeah, I love that. We're going to put some of the links to a couple of the orgs that you mentioned in our show notes so people can reach out to those resources or check out the websites. I think, you know, we talked about when we grew up and the demonization of foods. And I also just remember, like, you know, my running coach in high school was super supportive and amazing, but, you know, weight loss was always part of the conversation across the board with athletes. And in sports like running and even sports like gymnastics and cycling, you know, it's still given such an emphasis. So it seems like the earlier we can get a lot of body positivity and food positivity into the conversation, the better. And I'm glad that, you know, dietitians are taking that on head on, and also sports physicians. So yeah, thanks to you both for that. Because as a female and also as a mom, and I know Jason feels the same way as a dad, like it's just great to see this research being done and see more people talking about it.
Yeah, I grew up a competitive gymnast, and my coaches were great in supporting all of us, but we would always see other athletes come in from different gyms who didn't have that support. And, you know, being in my shoes now, it really kind of breaks your heart to understand what was happening at that age for some of these athletes too. And I think parents can have such a great influence on it as well. I think of, you know, my mom picking us up from school, we'd have our lunch boxes in the car to eat on the way to practice, or on our way home too. So there's a lot more work to be done, but those positive influence from parents, positive influence from coaches, and more research and having these discussions can really help move the needle and have lasting impacts.
Yeah. On that note, from both of you, like starting with Dana and then Karen, I'd love to hear what you think too. What do you feel like the next steps in research to further investigate RED-S bone health, but also some of the other health implications that REDs can have? What do you think we need? What direction do we need to go, or what are you most excited about?
Well, if we have another 2 hours, we come up with like 5 new research projects a week. I think to narrow it down to one, and then I'll kick it over to Karen, is the practical application of assessing energy availability. So we talked about how hard it is to do a dietary recall, the accuracy of that. So, and to measure that in a clinical study is challenging. So how can we meet the lab and mesh that with the real world to be able to have a better understanding of some of these nuances, whether it's timing or severity of energy restriction or deficit over time?
Yeah. I agree with Dana. How much time do you have for us to tell you all the things that need to be done? I will limit myself to 2. The first is funding. We're in a world where scientific funding for quality scientific research is under attack. And that's a problem. And especially when you want to study a problem that affects women more often than it affects men, it's a problem. So that's all I'll say about that. And yeah, to echo Dana, I think there's still a lot of physiologic studies that need to be done to understand the nuances of low energy availability and the timeline of detrimental effects and all of this. But what I also am really interested in recently is how do we treat it and what works for treating it in the real world? And it's an interesting problem because we're not coming up with just a medication, right? We're coming up with a holistic treatment strategy that ideally includes a whole multidisciplinary team, and you're not asking people just to make changes for the next 6 months while they recover from their stress fracture. You're asking them to make changes for the rest of their life to protect themselves against osteoporosis, to protect themselves against infertility. So there's a lot of really interesting, actually social science type questions that go into how do you build a good team? How do you educate people properly? And how do you get people to make behavioral change that's lasting?
Yeah, I love that, especially because we talked about all the different things that can lead to REDS, like whether it's intentional or unintentional, whether or not an eating disorder is involved, whether or not it's, an issue of miseducation or misinformation. And what you just said, I think, highlighted that the fact that the reason why you ended up with REDS could be different, and potentially then the way that you would help treat it over the long term should also be different. I'm curious, I mean, you mentioned the funding issue, which I think is very important and is an issue that we're dealing with currently. The funding that you guys have gotten for some of the great research that you've done, has that been mostly from like NIH or NSF, or can you speak a little bit to that piece?
Yeah, we received a grant from the American Sports. They just changed their abbreviation, so it's American Sports and Performance Dietitian Association. There we go.
I'm glad that you also have it, because I asked Jason, I'm like, okay, when it was CPSDA, I had it, and now ASPDA, I can't necessarily. I'm like, is it Sports Performance Dietitians Association? Yeah. So
yes. Yeah, so we received funding through ASPDA, and that has, was great in terms of getting our, feet off the ground, implementing it. And so we're still searching for funding now, and mainly looking at private funding mechanisms. And I think with the changes to the public funding mechanisms, we're now seeing a lot more people applying for these privately funded mechanisms. So I think to those out there listening, please support these organizations, because research is necessary, not just for REDS, but for all the other research going on right now in health sciences. And, that's the way that we can continue to keep funding this research.
It's hard. It's always been hard doing women's health and sports medicine research in the federal funding medical research infrastructure in the United States, because there's not really a home for women's health research. And so REDS, we have a hard time deciding, is it osteoporosis prevention? Is it mental health? Really, where does it fit? And especially when we're looking at high level athletes, it's a smaller population. So you have to get a little bit creative about how does this issue apply to the general population? So like Dana said, we end up looking a lot of private funding mechanisms. And fortunately, there's really starting to be a groundswell in people who are interested in investing in women's sports and in women's sports research. So that's something that I think is just really exciting to people like us who want to do good quality research in issues that affect women in particular, and then also affect men. And so that research is going to translate on both sides. But yeah, like Dana said, support your local women's sports organization.
Amen to that. Curious, kind of, I think, as a concluding question, if you have an athlete that suspects that they might be experiencing REDS, or may have a friend or family member that has symptoms that align with what you would see with someone experiencing REDS, what would you recommend that they do kind of as a first step to get help?
A sports dietitian, specifically. That's what I have to say.
Yeah, I think start reaching out, and like Karen was saying, looking for someone with sports specific knowledge, from whether that's a sports medicine physician, a sports dietitian, sports psychologist, because there are unique demands for athletes, whether you're a young athlete, a weekend warrior, a master's athlete as well. and really having that sports knowledge can understand some of these unique symptomologies that individuals will face.
And we can give you two, Shannon, to put in your show notes, just a couple of like certification letters that people can look for when they're looking at providers to see if it looks like they're finding someone who has the right education and qualifications.
Yeah, I think that would be great because often I think people across, you know, whether it's on social media or you find a website, often have different certifications. And it's hard for someone that may not know what a particular set of letters means or whether or not, you know, someone calling themselves a nutritionist, like what that real leaning into that, what that really means in terms of what training they've had and whether or not that training is really what would best support your needs is critical. So that would be great on both accounts, like both for dietitians and for physicians.
I'm curious, with such an incredibly complex issue with all the layers, are there a couple easy action items that as athletes and parents, we can kind of implement in our daily life? Obviously, there's no simple answer, but is there a couple things, a couple tidbits you might advise people to just kind of be conscious of?
One thing I like to start with my athletes is looking around the fueling around your training. I think you can get a lot of buy-in just by adjusting what you're doing before a training session and what you're doing immediately after. If you go into a training session well-fueled, maybe it starts with just having a couple of swigs of Gatorade before your morning run, or eventually working up to having a carbohydrate-rich snack before practice. An athlete often feels better during that training session, and that can be a great gateway to start talking more about nutrition throughout the day. And then building on that, immediately recovering after with carbohydrates and protein. That can help them feel better for the next day when they go into practice or their next training session. So I like starting there because I feel like that's a very tangible way for athletes to see the impact of what proper fueling can do for them. And I think that's a good gateway to opening that door for a bigger nutrition assessment and nutrition behavior changes there.
Yeah. I think everything Dana said, I think looking at recovery, making sure that sleep, rest periods are happening. And the other really important thing I see from a physician lens is people knowing their body, and anytime something happens that's not going right, asking why it happened. A low-grade tibia stress fracture that gets better and moving on, but right away asking, why did this happen? What are changes that I can make? Who can I bring into my corner to support me being healthy and not having this happen again?
I like that. Thank you. Appreciate some of the, like you said, taking such a complex issue and putting some easy action items for us just to, you know, fuel the workouts and then pay attention to what's going on. Pretty cool.
Yeah. Reading into or thinking about the why. And as we mentioned before, not just putting a Band-Aid on what the issue is. This has been such a fun conversation. Thank you so much to you both. I mean, we mentioned having enough material for two more podcast episodes, so maybe we'll have to have you back on. But this has been great. I think Jason and I were both really excited to discuss this topic with the two of you.
Thank you so much. It's really exciting to be on here and just love what you guys are doing at Gnarly and having these conversations to be able to support well-fueled athletes throughout an individual's entire life, not just as a child or as a college athlete, but for many years beyond. So thank you guys for having us.
Yeah. Well, we, as a thank you, are going to send you both, might take a little bit longer to get to you, Karen, since we found out that you're in London, but little gift packages with some Gnarstool merch, these amazing tumblers that we got from a brand partner up in Park City. They're called Summit. They're totally leak-proof, great at keeping things cold or keeping things hot. One of the things I love about them is that the lid that actually screws on and makes them leak-proof is magnetized, so it sticks on the bottom so you won't lose it, which I am really well known for losing things. And then we'll send you some Gnarly products as well. So just want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak to us on this really important topic.
Yeah. Thank you so much. It's been great.
Yeah. I want to echo Shannon. I really appreciate you guys taking the time, and the research you're doing is good and important research for athletes of all ages, and keep it up. We really appreciate everything you're doing.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Gnarstool Podcast.
Something of science.